Blog Talk Radio.
There's a lot to talk about today. So I got the breakdown of the Democratic debate, of course, as I'm sure all you were expecting. I also have some leftovers from the Republican debate, believe it or not. And mostly I think it's undercard bullshit, like Rick Santorum making an ass of himself. Perhaps there's another Huckabee clip, but I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it's just Rick Santorum. And then also it's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So happy MLK Day to everybody. It's actually a holiday that means something. Like, you know, as opposed to Christmas, which is just worshiping a fake Jewish zombie, stealing pagan traditions and capitalism and materialism and mixing it all together and then pretending like it's about Christianity. This is one that actually makes sense. So we're going to get into the legacy of MLK. And kind of like we do every year, I'm not going to give you the stuff that you already know. I'm going to give you the stuff that you might not know and the stuff that, in many respects, has been actively suppressed over the years. The stuff that they don't want you to know about MLK, because if you carry on fighting in his name and for his legacy, well, then the country might look a little bit different. In fact, it might look a little bit like Bernie Sanders is trying to make it look like. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then naturally, later on in the day, I got so much crazy stuff, man. I got fundamentalist religious, lunatics and just stories that'll make you bang your head against the desk. I got, believe it or not, in today's show, I actually have some, left-wing silliness, which is rare, but, every once in a while, the left can get a little bit silly here and there, and I'll show you exactly what I mean. And I think most of you will agree with me on this one. And then, unfortunately, some anti-Muslim hate crimes that have happened, obviously, in the wake of the terror attacks, the Paris attacks. So we're hitting every angle today. I got crazy Muslim fundamentalists. I got crazy anti-Muslim assholes. I got everything. So sprinkle it all in, roll it up in one show. All right, let's get started here. And I'm going to kick it off with a Democratic debate, and I'm going to go ahead and give you my debate breakdown. So who won the NBC Democratic debate that happened last night? Of course, it was buried on a Sunday because Debbie Wasserman Schultz wanted to make it so nobody watched it. I mean, think about that. It happened on a day where there were two NFL playoff games, and the day after is a holiday. Today is a holiday. It's Dr. Martin Luther King Day. So they're actively trying to hide it because they want to protect Hillary Clinton's lead, and of course the Democratic establishment wants her to win. The more you hear Bernie talk, the more people want him to win. So they're trying to hide it here so that people don't get the word. But in terms of who won, my take is that Bernie won. Now, I know a lot of you are going to roll your eyes and say that's just, you know, Kyle's bias talking. But understand, guys, I really mean it when I say I try my best to put aside my own bias as I watch these things. And I try to watch it through the eyes of your average Democratic voter. Of course, Democratic voter, when I watch the Democratic debates, I try to watch it through the eyes of your average Republican voter when it's a Republican debate. And I have to say, I think Bernie Sanders won, and I think he won fairly significantly. Now, at the beginning, that's actually not the case. So if you were to ask me within the first 30 minutes of the debate, I would have told you that Hillary Clinton is the winner, and she's the winner by quite a bit, because within the first 30 minutes of the debate, I think she was more on message, and I think that she was hammering away the one area where I think she has a genuine advantage, and she's genuinely to the left of Bernie Sanders, which is the issue of gun control. Now, she's not as far to the left of him as she's playing it up to be right now, and as the media is making it out to be. She's trying to highlight the areas where he's not in total lockstep with the left. But either way, I think she was strong on that issue. And if you asked me 30 minutes in, I would have said Hillary's winning, and she's winning by a decent amount. But then everything after the first 30 minutes or so, it was just Bernie Sanders all day long. I cannot tell you how many times he was able to successfully revert questions back to the issue of money and politics. And it wasn't a dodge. It wasn't a, hey, I'm not going to answer your question, and let's talk about what I want to talk about. It was more of a, okay, now that's a genuine issue, whatever the thing is they were asking them about, and let me tell you the root of the problem, which led to said issue. And then the answer was always money and politics. And he kept talking about how corrupt the system is and how billionaires own the politicians and corporations own the politicians and Wall Street owns the politicians. And he kept going on and on and on and on to the point where that gut feeling that the American people have about something's off and they're not representing us, Bernie was the one who came around and said, not only is that true, I'm going to give you the details of how that works. I'm going to get specific, and I'm going to give you the inner workings, and you're going to get it, and then you're going to vote for me because I'm going to do my best to change it. She's not. Of course, Martin O'Malley, I don't even know why we're bothering to mention him. I feel bad for the guy at this point. Dude, what are you doing? What are you doing? He's at like negative 27% in the polls. You know, it just felt like he was butting into a conversation and a debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And there were points in the debate where he was like, you know, let me just get 10 seconds before you want to. And then they cut to commercial. He's like, oh. There's another part where he's begging the moderators, like, if I could just have 30 seconds. On, oh. It's just, okay, man, it's not your day. It's not your time. I honestly think that Martin O'Malley, if he were to do something like this, you know, in the 90s, I don't know how old he would have been in the 90s, so I don't even know if he could have. But just his style and persona, and, you know, his version of being a politician, that's something that was successful back in the 90s during the Bill Clinton era, where it's kind of like a fake guy and a sleazy, typical politician, but he hits all the right talking points and stuff. And don't get me wrong, he's to the left of Hillary, and I would vote for him over Hillary, too. But it's just not his time, and he's just lagging behind. He hasn't been able to surge at all in the polls after any debates. And I love how before the debate, you had NBC commentators who were like, tonight's his night to surge. That's what it is. Like, oh, my God, you should be fired on saying that alone. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So I think that the moderators did a horrific job. I think they started out by attacking Bernie pretty strongly and, like, obviously trying to kneecap him the first however many questions it was, two or three. Later on, were they tough on Hillary? I mean, a little bit maybe, but they weren't nearly as tough on her as they were on Bernie. And they framed the debate around the early questions, one of them being the gun question. So they're immediately going for Bernie Sanders' perceived weaknesses. So I think overall they did a horrific job. They also had YouTube commentators, which pissed me off. Because they said something like, we'll be hearing from the most prominent voices on YouTube. Hello, you know, not to toot my own horn here, but in the news and politics category, Secular Talk is in the top 5% of Google preferred news. So when you look at, like, you know, hey, who's in front of me? It's like RT and the New York Times and like CNN and giant corporations. And then it's like me, the only individual actual YouTuber that's not a giant corporation that's there. And these assholes are like, news and politics, who should we get? I don't know, let's get this kid that looks like Justin Bieber with a fucking wig who doesn't even talk about politics. What the fuck, man? But obviously, they, you know, I don't know if I even came up in the prep for it, but they would dodge me even if I did come up, because obviously I would ask tougher questions than the bullshit that they're throwing out there. But again, overall, I think Hillary started strong, and actually, to be fair to Hillary, her closing statement, I think, was fantastic also, talking about the Flint water crisis and how this is unacceptable in America and how this isn't right and how we would have addressed it sooner if it wasn't for the race of the people who are largely affected. She had a strong closing statement as well, but overall, I think Bernie was the winner, and I think it was a landslide. So, again, that's just my opinion. You don't have to accept it if you don't want to, but I want to go ahead here and take a look at the polls, and then we can see if other people indeed agreed with me. So let's go to some of the internet polls here. Now, understand that these are not scientific, okay, but they're worth something. They're worth something. I wouldn't totally brush them off, and I wouldn't treat them as gospel here, but When you look at it, Huffington Post has Bernie Sanders with 71%, Hillary Clinton 21%, Martin O'Malley 8%. Slate has Bernie with 75%, Hillary Clinton with 19%, Martin O'Malley with 6%. Politico has Bernie with 70%, Hillary with 20%, O'Malley with 10%. NBC Nightly News has Bernie with 75%, Hillary with 17%, Martin O'Malley with 8%. Now, lest you think, well, wait a second, this is specific to Twitter, and the Twitter polls are even less scientific than the other Snap polls that are done on the website. Actually, the opposite is true. Just before I came on air here, I took a look at the Time Snap poll, which was done on their website. Bernie Sanders has 86% of the vote. Now, again, take it for what it's worth. You know, it's not the end-all, be-all. There are going to be scientific polls that come out later. You have to look at the methodology of those, too, though, allow me to say, because sometimes they're very weird in how they do them. But if I had to guess, even when the scientific polls come out, Bernie's going to win, but not by this big of a landslide as he wins in these polls. So there's the breakdown. For everybody who thinks that Bernie Sanders is not a serious candidate, that's just not true. You're living up your own ass. So let's acknowledge things for what they are. Let's understand that nationally, Hillary has a lead of about 12 points or so right now. But when you go to New Hampshire, there's some polls where Bernie's winning. You go to Iowa, there's some polls where Bernie's winning. These are the early states. If he takes one of those states, you know, it's up in the air, man. This election can go either way, and Bernie absolutely has a shot. And remember that he's been surging from day one. So there was one point where he was 40 points, 50 points behind Hillary. Now he's just 10 points, 12 points behind her nationally, and he's winning in some polls in Iowa and New Hampshire. If you don't feel the burn yet, you will. Okay. Now we get to specifics. When I say specifics, I mean our lovely little clips that we have here. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton went back and forth on their Wall Street plans at the debate last night, and Hillary tried to paint Bernie as anti-Obama, and here's his response.
I don't take money from big banks. I don't get personal speaking fees from Goldman Sachs. What I would do is understand that when you have three out of the four largest banks today bigger than they were when we bailed them out because they were too big to fail, when you have the six largest financial institutions having assets of 60% of the GDP of America, it is very clear to me what you have to do. You got to bring back a 21st century Glass-Steagall legislation, and you got to break up these huge financial institutions. They have too much economic power, and they have too much financial power over our entire economy. If Teddy Roosevelt were alive today, the old Republican trust buster, what he would say is, these guys are too powerful, break them up. I believe that's what the American people want to see. That's my view.
Secretary Clinton, help the voter understand the daylight between the two of you here.
Well, there's no daylight on the basic premise that there should be no bank too big to fail and no individual too powerful to jail. We agree on that. But where we disagree is the comments that Senator Sanders has made that don't just affect me, I can take that. But he's criticized President Obama for taking donations from Wall Street. And President Obama has led our country out of the Great Recession. Senator Sanders called him weak, disappointing. He even in 2011 publicly sought someone to run in a primary against President Obama. Now, I personally believe that President Obama's work to push through the Dodd-Frank bill and then to sign it was one of the most important regulatory schemes we've had since the 1930s. So I'm going to defend Dodd-Frank, and I'm going to defend President Obama for taking on Wall Street, taking on the financial industry, and getting results.
That's the record, right? In 2006, when I ran for the Senate, Senator Barack Obama was kind enough to campaign for me. 2008, I did my best to see that he was elected, and in 2012, I worked as hard as I could to see that he was reelected. He and I are friends. We've worked together on many issues. We have some differences of opinion. But here is the issue. Secretary touched on it. Can you really reform Wall Street when they are spending millions and millions of dollars on campaign contributions, and when they are providing speaker fees to individuals? So it's easy to say, well, I'm going to do this and do that, but I have doubts when people receive huge amounts of money from Wall Street. I am very proud. I do not have a super PAC. I do not want Wall Street's money. I'll rely on the middle class and working families.
Hillary Clinton is trying a very sleazy and disingenuous trick there. She's trying to play the Obama card and say flat out that, but Bernie's anti-Obama, Bernie's not on the side of Obama, Bernie's against Obama, I'm for Obama, I'm for his legacy, I'm in favor of it, and that's why I'm the better candidate. Don't look any deeper, don't look any further, that's it, that's the end of the debate right now, let's move along. Now, that's sleazy because it plays on the instincts of the Democratic loyalist base, the people who might not know all the details and ins and outs of policy specifics, but they know that more or less, Obama good, Republicans bad. Okay, and they usually, these are the people who defend Obama no matter what, even when he does something wrong. So she's exploiting that and using this as a trick to try to cut off the rest of the debate and the discussion, and that's the stuff that Bernie wants to focus on. Bernie's being very clear here. He's like, yeah, okay, let's be serious. Of course I was in favor of Obama winning in 08. Of course I'm in favor of him. I was in favor of him winning in 2012. I campaigned for him both times, and I worked with him on multiple issues. But just because he was better than Mitt Romney and better than John McCain does not mean that he's right about everything, and certainly does not mean that I'm not going to criticize him when he takes money from Wall Street and corporations and billionaires and then happens to do their bidding some of the time. Now, he's not as bad as the Republicans are with that stuff, but does he play the game? You bet your fucking ass he plays the game. And this idea that Hillary Clinton doesn't, are you kidding me? Let's take a look at this chart here. We showed this the other day. This is the amount of money made by Hillary Clinton giving speeches to big financial institutions just from 2013 to 2015. Look at this. For Ameriprise, Apollo Management Holdings, and Bank of America, she got $225,000 apiece for speeches that she gave to them. The Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, $150,000. Deutsche Bank, $485,000. Fidelity Investments, $225,000. Golden Tree Asset Management, $275,000. Goldman Sachs, $675,000. Morgan Stanley and UBS, $225,000. If you take that money from them, it's not because you're going to give a speech to them about abortion and give your opinion on it, and then they cheer and everybody goes home. That's not the way it works. They're giving you that money because there are strings attached. I scratch your back, you scratch mine. Hey, I'll give you money for giving a speech to us, but then if/when you're in power and you become president, you're going to remember that I gave you that money, right? You're going to remember about that corporate welfare check, that subsidy that I want, right? You're going to remember about that offshore loophole that I want to keep my money in the Cayman Islands, right? You're going to remember all these things that give me special favors and screw over the American people, right? And Bernie's saying, yes, of course the Democrats are better than the Republicans, but let's get serious, you guys suck too. And I'm not taking money from these big donors, from these corporations, from these financial institutions, from Wall Street. I'm going to look out for the people. So is Hillary's political trick here clever? Yes. Is it going to work in the end? I don't think so. I think people are starting to smell the bullshit, and we've seen in polls that a lot of people across America, not just Democrats but Republicans also, it's everybody, independents, you name it, people don't find Hillary Clinton trustworthy. Even among people who are like, okay, yeah, she's better than Republican alternatives, she's not trustworthy to them. They go, I don't know, something's a little off here. She seems like she's part and parcel of the establishment. And they're right in thinking that. So Bernie comes along and he's like, yeah, look, this is the problem with the system. The root of the problem is money in politics. I'm not partaking in that. Vote for me. People hear that and they go, oh, okay, this is a new thing we got going on here, huh? This is a guy who might actually represent us and do what the people want. This is kind of crazy. Should we go for that guy or the same old stale nonsense establishment democratic bullshit of we're slightly better than the Republicans and, oh, yeah, we also take Wall Street money? I think we know the answer to that one. Okay, next. Bernie Sanders was relentless in the Democratic debate in calling out money in politics. Here he went directly after Hillary. Let's watch.
Goldman Sachs recently fined $5 billion. Goldman Sachs has given this country two secretaries of Treasury, one on the Republicans, one on the Democrats.
Say it.
The leader of Goldman Sachs is a billionaire who comes to Congress and tells us we should cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Secretary Clinton, and you're not the only one, so I don't mean to just point the finger at you. You've received over $600,000 in speaking fees from Goldman Sachs in 1 year. I find it very strange that a major financial institution that pays $5 billion in fines for breaking the law, not one of their executives is prosecuted, while kids who smoke marijuana get a jail sentence.
Okay, he knocked that out of the park. He pulverized Hillary Clinton there. Oh my goodness. And I love the contrast at the end with, okay, you got rich white guys in suits and ties crashing the economy, more or less, and they're just roaming around free in their Lamborghinis out in the Hamptons, whatever. And you got a black person smoking a joint on his porch, and, you know, cops roll up and tackle him and then take him to jail. Okay, I think there's something wrong with the system. And for those of you who don't know, what Goldman Sachs did, like, this isn't a matter of opinion, this isn't a matter of let's debate it. Very simply, they had fraud as a business model, okay? They would take these subprime mortgage packages, just toxic packages. They would pawn them off and sell them to people, and they would tell these people, their clients, oh, you're going to make a lot of money off this, man. This is incredible. You're going to get so rich. I mean, what a steal this is. What a bargain this is. So buy these packages. As they're doing that, they would also turn around and bet on those same packages that they just sold as good. They would bet on them to fail because they knew that the packages were bullshit, okay? And this was monopoly money, and this was a bubble, and it was all going to blow up. So they made money two ways, selling it as if, oh, this is great, and then they would turn around and say, bet on it to fail. It's like a car salesman selling you a car that doesn't work and telling you, oh, no, you're going to make a lot of money on this, and then they turn around and bet that the engine's going to fucking fall out, and it does. They're just criminals. They're just criminals. And Hillary went and spoke to these people. Now, Bernie said she got $600,000 in a year. I don't doubt that. But from 2013 to 2015, she got a total of $675,000 for giving speeches to them. And as I always say, that's not because they're particularly interested in her position on gay rights or abortion. That is a bribe. It is a legal bribe. Everybody knew that she was going to run, and she's running this year. And so get your bribe in there early, and then if/when she's president, you come knocking on that door, Hillary Clinton's going to listen to you. I scratch your back, you scratch mine. You gave me nearly $1 million. Yeah, I'm going to look out for you. I don't know about you guys, but when somebody gives me $675,000, I kind of like them. I'm going to answer that phone call, okay? So Bernie's calling this out, man. And let me say this. Bernie, this is your strategy to win. He started out 40 points, 50 points behind Hillary Clinton. Now he's leading in some polls in Iowa and New Hampshire. And nationally, he's behind 10 or 12 points. Bernie, keep doing this. Keep hammering away. And he did this a lot in the debate. Everything would revert back to money and politics. Not because he's dodging questions, but because he's answering the questions and getting to the root problem that caused the issue. So it always comes back to, yeah, this is because of legalized bribery and money in politics and corporations and billionaires owning our political system. He would keep coming back to that, keep coming back to that, keep coming back to that. And do not hesitate, Bernie, to keep calling out Hillary by name and keep giving specifics about how much money she's taking. Do not hesitate. That works. That works. You tell everybody. Look, it's not me. I didn't make her take $600,000 from Goldman Sachs. She willingly took it. Ask yourself why that is. I didn't take any money from Goldman Sachs. Who do you think's more trustworthy on this? Who do you think's going to listen to Wall Street more? And she, you know, she tried to say at one point that her plan against Wall Street is tougher. That's comical. Bernie says, break up the big banks. You can't get more tough than that. And bring back Glass-Steagall, which separates investment banking from commercial banking and stabilizes the banking system. Hillary's not in favor of either one of those things. So spare me, Hillary. You want to pretend like you're to the left of him? You're not. You're simply not. And if he keeps hammering away like this, you're in a lot of trouble. Actually, scratch that. That's not true. You're already in a lot of trouble. Starting to feel that burn? Okay. We got to take a break. When we come back, I'm still not done, man. I got the issue of health care. They go back and forth on health care. And you're going to start to see Hillary's strategy crystallized here. It's an interesting strategy. It's a clever strategy. It might work, but that's up in the air. So we're going to see. And then later on in the show, I'll also get to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., honoring him for MLK Day. And then we got Rick Santorum. Little Ricky Santorum has a gift for immigrants. Yeah, that sounds creepy right off the bat, and it kind of is. All right, stay right there.
Choices always were a problem for you. What you need is someone strong to guide you.
Good night, man.
son of a bitch. All right, we're back, guys. Hey, by the way, real quick, on the break songs, for those of you who do the tweeting, just remember that the only rule, literally, is that it has to be longer than 3 minutes. And that's for obvious reasons. If I got to go take a piss or, you know, I got to straighten up the next segments that are coming or whatever, if I got to organize. So it needs to be at least 3 minutes. I've said that a few times, but still some people, I guess, just didn't hear me tweet about that back in the day. So when I ask for break songs, just keep that in mind. I say that because I think I had to skip over one of them today. And I tried the first few times if I had the time to spare to, like, ask and then wait for the response. But sometimes I'm tweeting too late to ask for you to pick another one and then wait for the response. So, anywho. All right. Still not done with the Democratic debate yet. Let's get to I'm sorry, Martin. I don't have any Martin O'Malley stories today, largely because he's super irrelevant and he said nothing interesting. That's not true. He said some good stuff on climate change. I think he's the only guy, though I'm not sure. I guess there's a chance Bernie said this and I didn't recognize it if he did. But O'Malley said we should get to 100% renewable energy by 2050, which is fucking ambitious, but it's also kind of fucking necessary. So he does say some good stuff, and credit where credit is due. He's just so far out of this thing that it's absurd. I'd prefer it. Believe me, I'd prefer it if it was O'Malley versus Bernie. I'd like that a lot more than if it was, you know, Clinton hanging out in there, the establishment Democrat 101. All right, but here they go on healthcare. Let's do it. Hillary and Bernie are going to go back and forth on the issue of healthcare here. And Hillary is going to use multiple disingenuous arguments. And also, we're beginning to see what her long-term strategy is here, her messaging and her framing that she's going to continue to use against Bernie. So let's listen, then we'll come back and I'll break it down.
We tried in the state of Vermont, and Vermont walked away from this kind of idea of Medicare for all, single payer, because they concluded it would require major tax increases, and by some estimates, it would double the budget. If you
Andrea,
couldn't
let
sell
me
it
just
in
say
Vermont,
this. Let
Senator,
me just say that.
How
you might
you
want
to
ask the governor
country?
Of the state of Vermont why he could not do it. I'm not the governor. I'm the senator from the state of Vermont. But second of all, here is what the real point is. In terms of all of the issues you've raised, the good questions you've raised, you know what it all comes down to? Do you know why we can't do what every other country, major country on earth is doing? It's because we have a campaign finance system that is corrupt. We have super PACs. We have the pharmaceutical industry pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into campaign contributions and lobbying, and the private insurance companies as well. What this is really about is not the rational way to go forward. It's Medicare for all. It is whether we have the guts to stand up to the private insurance companies and all of their money and the pharmaceutical industry. That's what this debate should be about.
Well, as someone who has a little bit of experience standing up to the health insurance industry that spent, you know, attacking me and probably will so again because of what I believe we can do building on the Affordable Care Act, I think it's important to point out that there are a lot of reasons we have the health care system we have today. I know how much money influences the political decision making. That's why I'm for huge campaign finance reform. However, we started a system that had private health insurance, and even during the Affordable Care Act debate, there was an opportunity to vote for what was called the public option. In other words, people could buy into Medicare. And even when the Democrats were in charge of the Congress, we couldn't get the votes for that.
Yes, because of what Bernie's talking about. She brings that point up as if it's a counter to what Bernie's saying. No, you're proving his point. He's like, the issue is that we have the health industry, both the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and everybody involved in this, they're so rich and they have so much money and they lobby Congress so much that people end up voting against the interests of the American people. That's what the congressmen do. That's what representatives and senators do. And then they come back to Hillary. She's like, even when the Democrats were in control and they had the ability to do a public option, they didn't do it. Right, because of what he's talking about, because of the influence of big money in politics. That's not a counter-argument. And notice, she's doing the same thing here that she did earlier in the debate, which is her new strategy. It's a clever strategy. I don't know if it'll work in the long run. I think it probably won't. But her strategy is, I'm going to paint myself as the third term of Obama, and I'm going to defend Obama's legacy, defend the positive things he did, and argue for it. But here's the problem. She's arguing for it as if it's a panacea, as if that's the answer, that, you know, everything was perfect in Obamacare, and if we choose to expand upon it, we're only going to expand upon it in an Obamacare-type way, which is continuing to have the private insurance companies in control, which is the root of the problem, of course. And, you know, she goes on there to paint Bernie as anti-Obamacare, and Bernie's like, hello, not only did I vote for it, I helped write it. So it's ridiculous to say I'm anti-Obamacare. I want to take the next logical step, which is Medicare for All. And what Hillary's trying to do is use Obama as a prop to say, he was right about it, and Bernie's against Obama, and I'm going to be the person that continues his legacy. Now, of course, this all disregards the deeper issue, too, which is Obamacare was a compromise bill. So to pretend like this, again, this is the end-all be-all, or this is, you know, such a great piece of legislation. No, it's the best we could have gotten given all the lobbying and given the breakdown in Congress. And for those of you who don't know, Richard Nixon was the first person to propose an individual mandate-type system, which is Obamacare, an individual mandate-type system. It was Nixon, and then later on, it was Bob Dole and his plan. This was a conservative plan in the 90s. Newt Gingrich and Chuck Grassley supported it. Far right-wingers, these guys are. And you had the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing think tank, writing policy papers about this, saying, we love this kind of health care reform because it keeps the private insurance companies in control. And it forces people to buy on the private market as opposed to doing a real liberal reform, which is Medicare for All, single payer. It comes out of your tax dollars, and it's government funded. So she's basically aligning now with 1990s Republicans. That's what she is. And that makes perfect sense because this is, you know, what has happened to the Democratic Party and what's happened to the political spectrum in general over time in the U.S. We've slowly but surely shifted to the right because the Republicans are so fucking insane and so obstinate that the Democrats have moved that way, and also the influence of big money has pushed everybody to the right. But to this idea that, you know, it actually is the better policy, Obamacare versus something like Medicare for All, wrong. Hillary Clinton believes it because she's paid to believe it. In 1993, she was arguing for single payer. Then what happened? After big money defeated her and her idea, well, then she learned how to play ball. And over time, she took money from the same interest that she used to bash, and now all of a sudden she's in favor of them still being in control and just doing tweaks to the system and not changing the heart of it. So how much money did she take from them? Let's take a look here. This is just from 2013 to 2015. Hillary made $2.8 million from 13 speeches to the health industry. Okay, so we have Advanced Medical Technology Association, $265,000. American Society for Clinical Pathology, $225,000. Beaumont Health System, $305,000. California Medical Association, $100,000. Drug Chemical and Associated Technologies, $250,000. Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society, London Drugs, National Association of Chain Drug Stores, National Council for Behavioral Healthcare, all $225,000 apiece for each speech to each of them. Novo Nordisk AS, $125,000. Pharmaceutical Care Management, $225,000. Premier Health Alliance, $225,000. And it continues here, Press Ganey, $225,000. Guys, this is why she believes what she believes. She's paid to believe it. Okay, she's going to do favors for these health companies that paid her. That's the way the system works. Bernie Sanders isn't taking Dickie McGee's acts from those people. So what's he going to do? He's going to do what he tells you he's going to do. He wants Medicare for All. He's going to fight for that. Think about this. Hillary Clinton, the leading Democrat, doesn't even want to fight for the Democratic position, which is single payer. She's starting by saying, I give up. I give up. I give up to the right, you know, let's do your old plan. Let's do a plan where the private insurers are still in control. Let's keep the pharmaceutical company still in control. I give up. I'm not even going to try. Bernie's at least going to fucking try. And guess what happens? With opposition, maybe with somebody like Bernie in there who fights for single payer, maybe he doesn't get that, okay? But maybe he does get a public option, which is what Hillary was saying we should have given up on in the first place. So maybe you do get the option to buy into a system like that. What a joke this is, man. We have somebody who's center-right and 100% corporatist leading on the Democratic side, and that's why Bernie is absolutely surging, because he's actually representing liberal positions. And by the way, these positions are positions that a majority of the American people are in favor of anyway. So Hillary, TikTok, perhaps your time is limited at the top. You're going to start to feel that burn. All right, more. Now we're going to move on to MLK. Because it's MLK Day today. Today is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and as usual, you're going to have people perverting his legacy for their own purposes today. Oftentimes, people on the right pretend like he agreed with them. They'll say he's a Republican. He wasn't. And furthermore, whenever people make that point to begin with, whether it's the Martin Luther King Jr. was a Republican point or the Democrats birthed the KKK point, what's the main thing they don't tell you? They don't tell you that the political parties switched at one point in American history. Okay, so the Democrats in the South, that was the conservative party back then. So you're not helping yourself. You're saying that those were the Republicans, basically. You're saying that those were the conservatives, okay? When you say Southern Democrats were racist, yeah, that was the conservative party then. So all those people are now on your side in the Republican Party because the party's flipped. They never tell you that part, but they love to say stuff like, yeah, the Democrats were the party of the KKK. So there's going to be a lot of that today. And what I want to do is break down the real MLK for you. Now, of course, you already know that he's a hero when it comes to desegregation and civil rights and voting rights. But there are other issues that he fought for, which have been actively buried. So first, let's go to healthcare and see what he had to say about that. Quote, of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. Okay, that seems pretty clear to me. I wonder what political candidate today best embodies that philosophy. I wonder what kind of system would best embody that philosophy. Without question, single payer or Medicare for all. There was, before I continue here, let me just throw out there, one of the articles I was reading earlier about this said that MLK even described himself as a democratic socialist. Who else describes themselves as that today? Let's think about that one. All right, so let me give you some more here. On a living wage, he said, quote, anything less than $2 an hour fails to give all Americans a decent standard of living. Now, in today's dollars, I should tell you, that's equal to about $15 an hour. So back then, he was saying, we got to do a living wage, and we got to tie it to inflation, and we got to make it so that if you work a full-time job, you're able to survive and afford basic necessities. That's not a radical idea. The radical idea would be the opposite of that. The radical idea is what we have right now. And yet again, I pose a question to you guys. Which candidate is it running today that best embodies that philosophy? Can't figure it out. All right, now on the issue of unionization, he said, quote, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining, by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone. Wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights. We do not intend to let them do this to us. Yet again, that's incredibly poignant, and it's still relevant today. We have all these so-called right-to-work states that are passing these kinds of laws, and effectively, what are they really saying? It's right to work for less. That's what it is. Because on average, these states, people make $1,500 less and have worse benefits. That's over the course of a year, $1,500 less. So it's not an open question. We know that unionization is better for the middle class. And here's MLK in his time saying, yeah, of course, we got to do more unionization, and we got to avoid the nonsense from the elitists when they say we got to do right to work, because they're just fooling you. It's that simple. They're tricking you into thinking the union is against you, when in reality the businessmen and the elitist class are against you, and the union would help you. Okay, and finally, let me give you here on militarism. He said, American involvement in Vietnam, quote, has torn up the Geneva Accord and strengthened the military-industrial complex. And he also accused the U.S. of being the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Damn. So keep everything in perspective here and understand that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., it's not like the only thing he cared about and fought for was civil rights and voting rights and things of that nature. It's not like he was limited to race issues. Brilliant on that front, and we all acknowledge that, and that's the history of him that we learn. But also in other areas, oh my God, there's still so much to do in terms of upholding his legacy and fighting for his vision. And is he correct in his vision? I would say absolutely he's correct in his vision. And on virtually every single issue, there's also quotes of him supporting Planned Parenthood at the time and reproductive rights. And when it comes to foreign policy, what, you think he would look at our 900 military bases around the world, the trillions of dollars we wasted in Iraq attacking the wrong country which did not attack us? You think he would look at this and say, oh, no, totally, I'm with the military-industrial complex. I'm with the defense contractors. Absolutely not. So just understand, you know, we have this ability to look back and say, look through rosy glasses and say, well, now we obviously all realize this guy was a hero. At the time, there was vicious opposition to him. Vicious opposition. There was a quote from Lyndon Johnson, who signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. When he spoke out against Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson called him, quote, a nigger preacher. So we have this ability to look back and say, well, obviously now we all agree. Martin Luther King Jr. was the right guy. We all agree. We all agree. Understand, at the time, he faced massive opposition. It was not a given that he was going to win. So today, when you stand up and say, we got to stop militarism, we got to stop U.S. imperialism, we got to stop the military-industrial complex, you're going to get a whole bunch of shit thrown at you, man. They're going to call you all kinds of names. They're going to tell you you don't understand. There are big problems in the world, and we got to police the world. We got to do this. We got to do that. When you talk about getting a living wage and tying it to inflation, they're going to tell you, oh, my God, you don't understand how economics works. You know, there's going to lead to inflation and this and that, blah, 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 blah. They're going to throw the book at you. They're going to treat you like a buffoon. They're going to say that you're on the wrong side of history. That's exactly what they said to him in his time. So keep fighting. Keep fighting. Eventually we win. And then 40 years, 50 years, 60 years down the road, they look back and go, that was obvious. I can't believe anybody would have argued against those people. They were obviously telling the truth. So this is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. It's one we should all uphold and fight for, because that's what he would want us to do, and he's right. Okay, now, let me do one more here, and this one actually is on money and politics. Then we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and I got a bunch of stuff in the final 30 minutes. I'll have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7 clips for you, if we can get to them, which is a big if. You never know. The Hill is reporting that Democratic Representative Steve Israel isn't running for re-election because of fundraising. He said, quote, I just don't think I could take another day asking another dollar for another. Okay, that sentence makes no sense. It says asking another dollar. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, my bad. The sentence makes perfect sense, and I'm an idiot. Let me try that again. He said, I just don't think I could take another day asking another donor for another dollar, getting ahead of myself there. Fundraising is just a relentless regimen. He said many people in his district do not feel that the government is working for them, calling attention to the need to reform campaign finance that in so many respects, I think, stacks the deck against those everyday Americans. Okay, so he's being crystal clear. He's saying, look, this is one of the main reasons why I'm dropping out here. And he goes on to explain, it takes up so much of your time if you're in Congress. If you're in Congress, you might spend the majority of your day fundraising. Now, let me ask you guys a question. Do you think that system is going to work for the people? If most of your day, every day, you have to wake up and you have to make phone calls and you have to talk to big money donors, you have to talk to businessmen, you need to talk to CEOs, you have to talk to people who are willing to give you money, you're calling, but most importantly, you're calling people who you know are big donors. For this guy on the Democratic side, the Republicans have their donors, their go-to donors, usually in the oil industry and Wall Street as well. But how can anybody expect that system to work for the American people? Because the people who they really end up working for are all the people who give them money. That's the way that the system works. And it's gotten to the point where even people who are within this system say, look, I don't want to deal with it on a personal level. Because it's not the heart of what you think you're signing up for, man. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, everybody gets grizzled and when they become a veteran and they get weighed down by the system and they just give up after a certain point. But do I think that a lot of the people who run to become Democratic politicians go in it meaning well and wanting to make a difference? Yes, I do. And on the Republican side, I think they probably do, but in a different way. Like, some of them will get in there and they're theocrats and they're Christian lunatics and they want to, like, impose Christianity on everybody because they think it's the right thing to do. But all of them end up just selling out to the donors. And the Democrats who start out meaning well and wanting to make a difference and care about people in their community, yada, yada, they learn very quickly, no, the way the world is and the way the government in the U.S. is, you got to get on that phone and you got to call people and you got to tell them, hey, I need your money because we got to win and we got to, you know, keep a majority and, oh, yeah, of course, I'll do favors for you if you give me the money. We have a system of open bribery and legal bribery, and it's right in front of our fucking faces. And even now, politicians are telling us that's what it is. We can't sit by any longer and watch this happen. The whole idea of a democratic republic and a representative democracy, or a constitutional republic and a representative democracy, is that your rights are laid out in the Constitution. They're off the table, okay? But everything else is open to democratic opinion. That's why you vote for people to represent you. Well, right now they just don't represent you. They don't give a fuck about your opinion. And that's why you always get these opinion polls that come out that say like 9% or 12% of the American people like what Congress is doing. We have to change it, man. We have to change it. Obviously, not only go out and vote for the right candidates on a federal level and for president and all that stuff, but also you have to fight, the game when nobody's watching, okay? It's one thing when you go in the voting booth and try to do the right thing in there. It's another thing when nobody else is paying attention to politics, you're making phone calls and you're a ground trooper for Move to Amend or for Wolfpack or for Represent.us. These are all groups that are fighting to either try to get a constitutional amendment or try to get money out of politics through all avenues. Look, I'm in favor of fighting this fight in every way, shape, and form, in every way, legislatively, constitutionally, you name it, you name it. So for those of you who aren't involved and you want to get involved, you got to check out wolf-pac.com because, you know, they're fighting the fight on this, man. They're trying to get a constitutional amendment, and they're doing it the right way, which is through the states and not through Congress, which is already corrupt. They're already corrupt. They're not going to vote money out of their own pocket. They don't like the process that they have to go through, but believe me, when they leave Congress, they're going to go get lobbying jobs and get fucking rich, okay? So they'll suck it up and make those phone calls when they're there so that they can get rich later. You got to force them to change that system, and you got to do it state by state. So check it out and sign up, and hopefully you can help out and make some phone calls or be a foot soldier. All right, now, let me take a break here. When we come back, I got a bunch of clips to get to, including Rick Santorum, and I got a bunch of crazy religious stories to get to as well. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. son of a bitch. Welcome back to the show. Man, I think I'm wearing a shirt that I forgot to wash. It smells funky. That's unfortunate. All right, so what I have now for you is some leftovers from the Republican undercard debate. This is something that it was myself and like four of my listeners who watched the undercard debate. And now we're reporting back to you. We watched it so you don't have to. I know a lot of you guys don't even watch the regular Republican debates. You're definitely not going to watch the undercard debates. In some ways, I think it's actually more fun to watch the undercard debates. And typically it's because some of the undercard people just go balls to the wall. They know they have very little chance. So, you know, you have Huckabee, like, throwing crosses and holy water at the audience and shit. All right, he didn't actually do that. But he did the functional equivalent of that, saying the Ten Commandments is the best way to get our country back, prayer in school, blah, 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 stupid shit. But here we got Rick Santorum, who probably agrees with that, but he's off on something else here. Rick Santorum has a gift, as he calls it, for kids from Central America and South America. Rick, take it away.
And when we say we need to send people back, I mean we send people back. And let me just make one point. I was in Storm Lake, Iowa the other day, near a Tyson's plant. 91% of the kids that go to elementary school there are minority kids. And they said, well, what are you going to do with all these people, their families? They've lived here for a long time. I said, I'm going to give them a gift. I'm going to give them a gift of being able to help the country they were born in. And we're going to export America. The education they were able to see, they learned the English language, they learned about capitalism, they learned about democracy. You want to stop the flow of immigrants? Let's send 6 million Mexicans, Hondurans, Guatemalans, El Salvadorans back into their country so they can start a renaissance in their country so they won't be coming over here anymore.
Okay, he just said that deportation is a gift. And it's a gift for kids from El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras. For those of you who don't know, some of those places literally have a higher murder rate than Iraq did during the height of the Iraq War. That's a stunning fact. It's an unbelievable fact. When I first heard it, I didn't believe it. I went and I checked. Turns out it's true. So Rick Santorum is bragging and boasting about it. I got something for them. I got a gift for them. Go back to the place where you'll almost certainly die and go run into the arms of the drug gangs. You're going to deport them to countries with a drug war going on right now and a higher murder rate than Iraq during the Iraq War? Are you fucking crazy, man? Are you crazy? And this guy likes to pretend like he's the most Christian out of everybody in the race. No, Rick, you only care about Christianity when you can use verses to back up your own crazy far right-wing ideology. And there are plenty of those verses, don't get me wrong. He has theological backing for the shit that he says. But he also disregards Jesus on economics. You know, the guy who's flat out anti-rich and totally in favor of the poor and helping the poor. He pretends like that part doesn't exist. And he pretends like the part about immigrants don't exist. You know, this is another area where the Bible is perfectly clear. Hey, you have to treat the immigrants, the sojourners, as if they are your brother. Let them in your house. Care for them. They're your neighbor. You cannot do any wrong to them. He's like, I'm going to deport you back to a drug war where you'll almost certainly die. And then also, look, man, so let's say, you know, you're a cold-hearted prick and you were going to advocate for this. At least also have the common sense to realize what the fucking problem is. And to make their country safer. How would you make their country safer? Now, you guys know me. I'm not a nation builder. I don't want to go there and be directly involved and, you know, whatever, build infrastructure and all this stuff there. No, I want nothing to do with that. But the least we could do is stop the fucking drug war. Because there's a reason why you have incredible violence in these places. Because since drugs are illegal in the U.S., you've given the drug cartels a monopoly. When you give them a monopoly, you give them all the money. They become much more powerful. And oftentimes, they buy a lot of the politicians in these places, too. And they control things. You know, some places in Mexico, it's just flat out a narco state. They have mega cartels at this point, which replace the other cartels, which were bad enough. So the least you could do, if you're going to deport kids, at least end the drug war so that you starve the cartels of money and they eventually collapse. And then after that, we can start, you know, they can start building up their own country and having industries other than drugs that, you know, are better industries and more healthy industries for the people of their countries. But this is, you know, Rick Santorum 101. Say the craziest, most callous, cold-hearted shit imaginable, and then talk about how much you love Jesus and act like, you know, you're the open-minded one and open-hearted one. And everybody else is crazy. No, Rick, I think you should look in the mirror. Okay, next. I got one more little Ricky here. Rick Santorum exposed his ignorance on the issue of foreign policy last night. There's a lot to say about this. Let's watch.
Well, the historic promises that we've made to Iran in this agreement need to be torn up on the first day in office of the next president. And let me tell you why. Because Iran has already torn it up. Iran has not approved the agreement that President Obama has said that they have approved. They've approved a different agreement in their parliament. Let me tell you this. If you choose to serve this country, I will have your back. I will not let America be trampled upon anymore by these radical jihadists. The bottom line is, I put the original sanctions on the Iranian nuclear program when I was in the United States Senate. I've been fighting for 12 years with one thing in mind, that we must stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And because they're different than every other country. They do not want a nuclear weapon to defend themselves. They want a nuclear weapon for theological ends, to bring about their Mahdi so they can control the world. And that is the most serious threat facing this country right now.
Iran is the most serious threat facing this country right now. Iran is. Not jihadism, not Salafism, not ISIS, not Al-Qaeda. And I'm talking about military threats at this point. Not Russia, not China, nothing like that. And really, when you talk about existential threats, not climate change. Of course, Rick Santorum doesn't even believe in that. Don't be stupid. Climate change being a problem, affecting future generations? Shut up. So none of that, no. Iran is the biggest threat. Because with their military budget of 17 cents and a Pop-Tart, they're going to, you know, wipe Israel off the map, destroy Saudi Arabia, destroy all the other Sunnis which surround them. For those of you who don't know, Shia are a tiny percentage of the overall Muslim population in the Middle East. They're going to destroy all of them and then take down America, who has the strongest military in human history ever, ever. They're the biggest threat facing us, except they're not the biggest threat facing us. So what you're saying, Rick, is just not correct. Now, furthermore, if only this guy read the deal, he would like President Obama. Actually, that's not true. He'll read it and then pretend like he didn't read it and pretend like it doesn't say what it says. But the reality is, if you're so concerned about Iran getting a nuke, as he is, and he said, that's my main concern, okay, well, then that's what the deal prevents. The deal prevents Iran from getting a nuke. I know it's hard to read. It's tough. Once you get to page 3, you get all antsy and you want to turn on and watch SportsCenter. I get it. I get it. Or actually, you want to turn on and watch some weird religious channel probably. But understand that that's what's in the deal. And that is what they signed on to. And in fact, they just the other day turned over enriched uranium. So they're upholding their part of the deal. And then, of course, we had the swap. Five of our prisoners or so were released. We released about 7 of their prisoners. And now we've lifted sanctions, and now there are more business dealings. And it looks like we have a a brighter future. I'm not talking about being buddy-buddy and going on vacation with Iran and the mullahs, okay? But a neutral stance would be preferable to being on the brink of war, the verge of war, for all this time. But again, you say the main purpose of the sanctions was to stop them from getting a nuke. Well, mission accomplished. You have the sanctions, then you have the negotiations. Now you have a deal that cuts off their path to a nuke. He did what you say you want, and you still don't give him credit. And then, finally, dude, he called Iran radical jihadists. That's it. You're done. I can't have you as president. Nobody should consider you to be president. If you don't understand the very basic difference between Sunni and Shia, and you don't understand, you know, who the jihadists are today, there are Salafi jihadists. They're extremist Sunnis. If you don't understand that, that's it. I mean, it's embarrassing that you're even running Iran for all of their problems. And the ideology is horrific, and they are in many ways a theocracy. But they are Shia Islamists. You know, well over 80%, probably over 90% of the attacks against the West are from Wahhabi Muslims, Salafi Muslims, jihadists. That's radical Sunni ideology. They're not Shias. So to call them, you know, radical jihadists, call the government of Iran radical jihadists, that's just not true. You just don't understand the Middle East. You have no clue what the fuck is going on. So how am I supposed to trust you to even understand basic facts? Like, Iran is fighting ISIS right now. They are fighting ISIS. That's right, they're fighting ISIS. These guys should have their cake and eat it too. ISIS is the biggest problem facing us, and the government of Iran is too. Which is it? They're fighting each other. Which one is worse? Which one is the bigger threat? But they don't care about that. They don't care about logic. They don't care about facts. It's just about demonize. Be afraid. Vote for me, I'll protect you, even though I don't know dick about dick. All right, now let's get off this completely and get to some religious stuff here. A bunch of religious stuff. Iceland Magazine is reporting on an incredible new poll on religiosity in their country. Listen to this. They say less than half Icelanders claim they are religious, and more than 40% of young Icelanders... By the way, how do you say that properly? Icelanders, Icelanders, whatever. You know what I'm saying. Less than half, 40% of Icelanders claim they are religious, and more than 40% of young Icelanders identify as atheist. The new poll failed to find young Icelanders who accept the creation story of the Bible. Damn. They say 93.9% of Icelanders younger than 25 believe the world was created in the Big Bang. 6.1% either had no opinion or thought it had come into existence through some other means. And 0% believed it had been created by God. Wow. 0% of young Icelanders believe the world was created by God. You want to talk about secularism on the rise, irreligiosity on the rise. That is a stunning number. Now, Scandinavia, when you poll the population, they've always been more non-religious than the U.S. In fact, most of Europe has been more non-religious than the U.S. You look at Britain, for example. We covered the story recently. There's an increase in, you know, atheism there as well, or just non-belief there as well. So they've always been in front of us in that category. But this is a number that, this is like a breakthrough here. So for young people in Iceland, 0% say the world is created by God. Zero. That, as of right now, is unthinkable in the U.S. We're going to take a long time to get to that. Now, millennials are much more non-religious. But no, there's way more than 0% that believe God created the earth. When you look in the U.S., it's anywhere from 20 to 23% of the entire population that are non-religious, or they're in the nuns category, the unaffiliated category, which simply means they're not part of an organized religion. But in that group, there are a lot of people who believe in God, they're deists, or they're spiritualist and they believe in some sort of New Age thing like that, or they're agnostics. When you actually get to atheism, that number is much lower. It's like 2% to 5% of the U.S. population. So we're still way behind, but this number, man, this shows you that given enough time, given education, and given, I think, modern entertainment and the internet and stuff like that, there's a progression away from religion. Why? Because religion, in all of its forms, is based on myths and fairy tales. Even if you're somebody who argues that, oh, well, it's all a metaphor. Well, okay, then you're admitting that the literal claims made are not true. So in a way, you're aligned with these secular people, these non-religious people. So given enough time, you know, with the availability of information today, and also I think this has to do with level of income in the sense that they have a good social safety net. They have universal health care, universal education in these places. And, you know, there's an old argument made that, like, atheism is a luxury for the rich. Or, you know, you could say a luxury for middle class and up, something like that, where usually people who are more well-off and have higher education are more likely to be non-religious. Well, the more there's a move in this direction across the world, the more we have social democratic policies, the more we move away from corruption, you're going to see a progression towards not believing, okay? And this is a positive thing in so many ways, most importantly, for politics. Because, look, there's no problem with somebody being a religious person. I might not agree with them, but whatever. If they're a religious person, they're a religious person. The real problem just comes about when you're a theocrat and when you want to marry church and state or mosque and state or temple and state or just religious institution and state. That's when it's a problem, because then you're saying, I want to force my voodoo nonsense fairy tales on you. Well, now we're going to have to come stop you, okay? So, you know, even if we get to a point where, let's say, there's still a tremendous percentage of the world and these populations in different countries that are religious, totally fine with that. But if we get to a point where we have 100% belief in secularism, that's a win across the board for rational people all around the world. And, you know, we got to keep moving in this direction. So more education, push more towards intelligent policies economically, and more people speaking their mind on what they think is true about the nature of the world, more science, more enlightenment, and it's only a matter of time until we chip away and see numbers like this in more countries. Okay, more. So a 43-year-old Muslim man named Mujibur Rahman was it the Bronx? Yeah, I think it was the Bronx. Let me try that again. So a 43-year-old Muslim man named Mujibur Rahman was walking his 9-year-old niece home from school in the Bronx, and two men viciously attacked him. They beat him. They punched him in the face. They knocked him to the ground. They kicked him repeatedly, all while the 9-year-old was standing there watching. He was taken to the hospital to be treated for his bruises. But what makes this story particularly noteworthy is that as the attackers were beating the shit out of him, they were screaming, quote, ISIS, ISIS. So the International Business Times reports here, quote, in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, anti-Muslim crimes in the U.S. jumped 1,600% after the 2005 London bombings. Police reported that the rate of hate crimes in the city, mostly targeting Muslims, rose sixfold in the 3 months following the attacks on Charlie Hebdo in France earlier this year, last year. Anti-Muslim incidents rose 281%. So what we see here is a trend. Whenever there's Muslim fundamentalist terrorism, there's always a backlash and a rise in anti-Muslim bigotry and anti-Muslim hate crimes. And oftentimes, it's not just against Muslims. It's against Sikhs. It's against Hindus. It's against Buddhists. is against anybody, and you don't look quite white enough, or you look like you might be part of a different religion, and people attack. So, look, man, very simple takeaway from this story here. Just don't be an idiot, okay? Don't do collective punishment. We're all mad about Muslim terrorism. Absolutely. No question about it. We're all against it, okay? All rational, sane people are against it. But that means what you do is you try to bring those people who did the attacks to justice, or in the case of ISIS, you try to bring the group who did it to justice. That doesn't mean that any Muslim you see anywhere in the world at all times is by definition ISIS, and they agree with ISIS, therefore you attack them. No, if you think that, you're an idiot, you're a bigot, you do generalize about Muslims, and you're doing violence on them in that case. They ain't doing it to you, so you're the bad guy in that scenario, dipshit. This shouldn't be that hard to fucking get, man, okay? Just don't do collective punishment. We're all against terrorism. We should all be against violence and a backlash like this. Let's just be sane. Let's be rational. Not every Muslim is guilty for the actions of terrorists. But in this case, you have a bunch of idiots who believe that that is the case, so they attack. No, that's not the case. Again, let's be smart about it, and let's oppose both the terrorism itself and the ridiculous backlash against all Muslims. Now we go in the other direction here and talk about a huge problem coming out of Pakistan. The Independent is reporting on a mind-blowing story coming out of Pakistan. They say, quote, a move to ban child marriages in Pakistan has been withdrawn after meeting staunch resistance from a religious body which branded the bill as anti-Islamic. The ruling party politician who introduced the bill, Marvin Menon of the Pakistan Muslim League Party, withdrew it after the Council of Islamic Ideology, or CII as it's called, dubbed the bill, quote, blasphemous. They rejected the bill on, and I quote again here, purely religious grounds. CII Chairman Mohammed Khan Shirani said the bill contradicted Islamic teachings. He said, Parliament cannot create legislation that is against the teachings of the Holy Quran or Sunnah. Now, the current minimum age for marriage is 16 years old for women and 18 years old for men in Pakistan, but that's just ignored. And they say, no, 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 I get to have child wives because of Islam, because religion. So everybody shut up, I get to have my child bride. Quote, in May 2014, the council reiterated its earlier ruling that girls as young as 9 years old were eligible for marriage if the signs of puberty are visible. Okay, now, no. Absolutely, positively, 100% no. I don't give a shit if you say, no, I get to do this because of Islam. Because of my religion, and my religion is in a particular category where you ain't allowed to criticize it, so therefore, I get to fuck a 9-year-old. I say, take your religion, shove it up your ass, and go take a hike. You ain't marrying a 9-year-old. Why? Because just because you proclaim religion, sacred, deeply held belief, Islam, just because you proclaim that, doesn't mean that those ideas and concepts are not open to scrutiny. On the contrary, not only are they open to scrutiny, religious ideas should be more open to scrutiny, particularly because people say, this one's off the table, this one you can't discuss, this one's, you know, such a deeply held belief, and it's sacred, so we gotta be allowed to do it. No. And this is why I've always said, secularism is non-negotiable. Secularism is a human right. Secularism is a fundamental human right. Because, okay, I'm in favor of everybody being allowed to be religious or whatever the fuck you want to be. You could be Muslim, you could be Christian, you could be Hindu, you could be Buddhist, you could be whatever. That's fine. The problem comes about when you start taking away the rights of others as a result of your religion, or you say, I'm going to force my religion on everybody else through the state. Use the power of the state and the violence of the state to force my religion on everybody else. No, 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 no. Just because you're a Muslim or you're a Buddhist or you're a Hindu or you're a Christian doesn't mean you have to force everybody else to believe what you believe, and certainly doesn't mean that you get to violate the rights of the 9-year-old girl and fuck her, which is rape. Let's be clear about that. In the name of my religion, I'm allowed to rape, or not, or not. You don't have a right to, in the name of your religion, do anything you want, because where does that end? Well, not only do I get to rape 9-year-olds, I get to kill people who disagree with me, because my religion says I'm allowed to kill people who disagree with me. Well, I don't give a fuck if your religion says that. You are wrong, and we do not allow that. I mean, think about that trick. Imagine if secular people did that. Imagine if atheists did that. No, no, it's cool. In the name of my atheism, I get to rape a 9-year-old. Everybody would say, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You should be put in jail immediately. Well, it's the same thing for Muslims. If you're a fundamentalist Muslim and you believe this and you act on this, well, then you should be fucking locked up. That's it. It's the end of the conversation. You don't get to say, this is in a category you can't criticize, therefore I get to fuck a 9-year-old or rape a 9-year-old and marry a 9-year-old. I don't give a shit if you say it's in my holy book and it's off the table. That's the thing, it's not off the table. And it's also not true. Okay, I'm sick of this bullshit and pussyfooting around beliefs that are obviously absurd. Just because it's in a 1,000-year-old book that was written in the desert by a guy who allegedly flew on a flying donkey, who allegedly was on a flying donkey, doesn't mean that I'm not going to criticize you. It means that not only am I going to criticize you, I'm going to laugh as I'm doing it because you believe in a fucking flying donkey? Really? You believe semen comes from the backbone. This is in the Quran as well. This is what you believe? You believe over time Jews become apes and Christians become pigs and gays become elephants. It's in my religion. It's in my book. It must be true. Except it's not true. We had the Enlightenment. We had science. We have science. Empirically test things. We can determine whether or not a claim like that is factual or not, and it ain't fucking factual. People don't live to over the age of 900. This is not only in the Bible. This is in Islamic texts as well. It's nonsense, and you're using these documents to say, oh, well, it says it in this book, so it's off the table. That means it should be more ripe for criticism, not less ripe for it. You don't use that as law, and that's the end of the conversation. You want to be religious, fine, but you can't take away the rights of other people, and you can't say, this is the document that we're going to run our government on. No, we do that based on logic and rationality and democracy and human rights and constitutional rights. So everybody has a right to be religious or non-religious or whatever the fuck you want to be. But that does not give you the right to take away the rights of others, including 9-year-old girls who you apparently want to rape. Okay. I got to squeeze in one more here. And then I'll do another one. I got so much, man. I still got a lot more left here. Okay. Let me do one more, and then I'll save two of these for tomorrow. The Independent is reporting on an incredible story that honestly sounds more like a parody than reality. They say, quote, Swedish police will no longer be able to give descriptions of alleged criminals for fear of being seen as racist. Huh? They go on. According to an internal letter, police in capital city Stockholm are instructed to refrain from describing suspects' race and nationality. The letter was written by Stockholm police press officers and said crimes should be reported externally via the police website without descriptions. Quote, we want to avoid pointing out ethnic groups as criminals, said one of the officers. The letter says, quote, criticism is sometimes made against police regarding information about people's skin color. It is perceived as racist. As police are not racist, nor shall be constructed as so, this directive is now applied. Okay, think about what they're saying here. They're like, to prove that we're not racist, we will never say the race of somebody who commits a crime who isn't white. Okay, that wouldn't prove that you're not racist. That would prove the other thing. That would prove indeed you are. And it would prove you're actually bigoted against white people. Well, if the white people do it, of course you can report it, because they're white. Of course, report it. If they're not white, don't report it. That might be racist. So in the name of standing up against racism, you are now saying that even if it's factual that a different race commits a crime, we're not going to say anything about it because it's a different race who committed it. Oh, this is fucking Looney Tune land, man. This is literally like a caricature of what a liberal is supposed to be. Are you serious? You can't put ideology above facts. And it doesn't mean if you report that a minority commits a crime, that doesn't mean that therefore every minority is guilty. It just means that in this case, a minority committed a crime. Those are facts. That's data. That's information. But they say, no, even if it's factual, even if it's data, even if it's information, that's racist. But that's not racist. You're just saying it's racist. Okay? How have we twisted ourselves into these, intellectual pretzels, this mental gymnastics to say, if the other commits a crime, it's not even a crime, or we're not even going to acknowledge it, we're not going to pay attention, because even acknowledging it is racist. Well, then you quite literally are sticking your head in the sand, okay? As liberals, what your job is, and what my job is as a liberal, is just always to discuss the facts. That's it. That doesn't mean you say all immigrants or refugees or, minority communities or Muslims are rapists or criminals or whatever, because that's not true. But that certainly doesn't mean you don't discuss it when there is a crime committed by a minority. You have to stand up on the side of facts. And by the way, this is an example of if you don't talk about this, the far right is going to talk about this, and more people are going to flock to the far right because what they're going to say is, I might not agree with those guys on everything, but at least they're willing to call a spade and say if somebody in a minority community committed a crime, that a crime was committed. At least they're acknowledging the facts of reality and not picking ideology over reality. So you're giving the far right an opportunity to take control here. You're giving them an argument here. How about you don't do that? How about you discuss the facts? If somebody who's in the minority community commits a crime, fucking say it. Say it. Again, that doesn't mean they're all guilty, but it means sometimes minorities commit crimes. That's it. That's all it means. Thou dost protest too much. Why are you so afraid to talk about it? Just fucking talk about it, give the facts, and then have smart policy solutions to all this stuff. If you try to censor and shut down and run from facts, then you're never going to get to smart policy proposals to actually fix any situation. All right, guys, I'm out of time. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow. Peace.